Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about nutrition politics and the destruction of scientific integrity by Professor Emeritus T. Colin Campbell from the Nutrition Studies at a very important college up at Ithaca, Cornell University. We're also going to look at the effects of beet juice on helping your muscles if they're fatigued and tired, and how women are nearly 300% more likely to get breast cancer with common hormone replacement therapy. Also, how we can live a longer life by doing simple things, and I'll tell you what some of those simple things are. And also, those of you using antidepressants, according to this latest study published in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry, 69% of you, well, you're not clinically depressed, therefore they're of no value, therefore they're harmful, and a lot more on health and healing. Today, also a commentary from Free Inquiry, Kerry Walters on the myth of America's Christian heritage, and something I'm going to ask the audience to think about and call in on, Michael Snyder, Economic Collapse, who controls all the money in the world? What if I told you it was an unelected, unaccountable group that meets every 2 months in secret? They're not even allowed to have a secretary or anyone recording, writing, taking notes. And they control more money than any other person in the world. Wow. And they've been around a long time. We'll have a discussion on them. My guess I'm going to have a little earlier in the program is Lori Van Aken. She is one of the individuals called the Jersey Girls who lost her husband Kenneth on September 11, 2001, when American flight flew into the North Tower at the World Trade Center. Her husband was killed. She was left with two children. And she's concerned that as a member of the Family Steering Committee for the 9/11 Commission, as well as the group that fought for 9/11 input, that the President of the United States does not want Saudi Arabia held accountable, even though the missing 28 pages clearly indicates that they were one of the funders and behind the September 11th disaster. So we're going to put that in perspective. We're going to look at the angle from her perspective, and we'll try to understand the angle from the State Department and major corporations, the President of the United States, and Hillary Clinton. Is it worth making them financially and legally responsible for masterminding this terrorist attack and financing it, hiding the criminals, if at the same time, it ends up costing some political embarrassment, because a lot of people knew about this, FBI, National Security Agency, Homeland Security, the President, his special National Security Advisory Team, CIA, everybody knew it. But then you have to balance, in our society, you have to balance. What's the value of not allowing this to happen and holding them harmless versus telling the truth and then allowing the victims and their families to sue Saudi Arabia for damages, and also all the cleanup and everything else that was involved in it, and also criminal prosecution and all the different implications of that. So it'll be a discussion. I'm going to ask you at that time to call in after she's on and share your points of view and talk back. Also today, we're going to look at some other issues involving our world, the world we live in, and I'm going to ask you to respond. I don't know how many of these we're going to be able to get to, but I definitely want to hear from a nurse warning of biologicals and forced flu shots happening in U.S. hospitals. This is a whistleblower nurse, and she describes her experience inside a hospital taking orders to unknowingly force vaccinate patients with a flu shot. They're not aware they're getting a flu shot. And she talks about how all this is impacting her and others. And then we're going to hear from how Israelis literally are getting away with murder, and how leading Zionist, and whose family was one of the founders of Israel, modern-day Israel, has seen what Zionism has come to mean and is speaking out about it. In fact, he was one of the heads of the Zionist and Jewish Congress in the United States. But right now, if you read Haaretz and some of the other leading progressive newspapers in Israel, you'd see that there's a very strong criticism of the Netanyahu government and his Likud party and the other far-right wing people for what they're doing to destabilize Israel and actually make it more insecure because of their apartheid approach. We'll hear from that gentleman. I don't know if we'll have time, but I thought we would at least try to let you see one more clip about how the Clintons literally control Haiti. They control everything about the body politics in Haiti, but more importantly, with the Haiti Relief Fund, they're in control of it. And how none of the citizens of Haiti benefited, but the NGOs made off like bandits, that they are. And the Clintons' friends who donated to the Clintons, and the people who gave huge lecture fees to the Clintons, they got the contract. Now, was this contract to build new schools and homes, water treatment system, sewer system? No. No, they made their money in the north of Haiti, where there was no earthquake damage, in an industrial park where they could then use the Haitians, who were already poor, at slave labor to manufacture products that can be exported and sold for enormous profits. But first, they had to donate to the Clinton Foundation, and they did. Just want to show you the contempt that the average Haitian has for what the Clintons and others have done to their country, and yet the American media will not touch this. They will not show the overt corruption to a devastated population. And so they continue to get away with it. We'll explore it. So you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. Recently, I was as a part of a new film that will be premiering very shortly. We're in the last 2 weeks of both filming and editing. I interviewed Professor T. Colin Campbell, and he has been at this university for, 46 years. And here's what he has to say. I thought you'd find this important. August 1st was 60 years since I came to Cornell University to do graduate studies in nutritional biochemistry on the topic of food and health. What a journey this has become. In my early days, the focus of good nutrition emphasized the consumption of protein. So it was with me and my professors. The more protein, the better. Even better, the more so-called high-quality protein from animal sources we consume, the more health we would have. That was consistent with my personal background on the farm, milking cows with my graduate research devoted to a more efficient way of producing animal-based protein, and my early career helping to resolve childhood malnutrition in the Philippines by making sure that they got more protein. Lots of people thought that there was a protein gap in the world, especially in poor countries. But surprisingly, in the Philippines, I got an impression that children of the few Filipino families consuming the most animal protein seemed to have higher risk of liver cancer. That was a really odd observation. About the same time, a research study in India showed a very similar effect. Initiated by the most potent liver carcinogen known, all those animals consumed higher protein, dietary protein, and they got liver cancer, while no animals, not a single animal, fed a lower dietary protein got cancer. But the results were so dramatic and so provocative, I applied for and received research funding from the U.S. National Institutes of Health to investigate this crazy observation. Does more protein consumption mean more cancer? If so, what is the biological mechanisms for this effect? Funding for this grant was repeatedly renewed for the next 27 years. Although initially I was more interested in using dietary protein to modify cancer development in order to better understand how cancer works. So here it was, a really challenging idea that had the potential, if proven to be true, to cause disruptive thoughts. It also meant that our experimental research had to be airtight, capable of withstanding what might be an explosive reaction if this effect proved to be true. As a result, scientific research would become my cup of tea. It is a discipline that demands the production of authentic evidence, the kind that could be published in peer-reviewed science journals where it gets critiqued by other professionals, and even better, that might be meaningful for the public, especially since it was the public's money that was being used to support this research. I truly loved my work, both in doing the research and working with many graduate students and fellow colleagues who collaborated with us, formulating hypotheses, designing experiments, interpreting results, and asking what's next. And then he goes on to talk about all this research for all these years, and still the belief that the more protein you ate, the more beef and chicken and eggs and dairy, the better you were. And then what changed all this is when he took a trip to China. And all over China, he found that those who had the least amount of animal protein or no animal protein, but had plenty of other foods, you know, tubers, root vegetables, grains, legumes, tofu, had the least cancer, lived the longest lives, and were healthiest overall. And as a result, he brought this back. This was called the China Study. Now, mind you, there were many people who had done a lot of research on veganism, vegetarianism. Loma Linda University had hundreds of papers on living a longer life by being on a vegan diet. But Loma Linda University and medical school is not Cornell University, one of the major Ivy League schools. So, quote, I entered academia when thinking it to be an ideal world, a place of honest discourse and debate. It was to be a place where it would be comfortable to think freely, in addition to accept the necessity at times of being wrong. Indeed, for most of my years, it was bliss, especially working with dedicated students and colleagues in research laboratories and lecture halls. I found that being free to investigate a hypothesis as I wanted and lecture as I believed to be reliable and helpful, publishing our results as we learned them, was a great world to live in. But I would be remiss if I did not also say that times have changed. Academia during the last 30 years has changed. It has changed in a way that encroaches on that little notice but societally precious academic freedom, usually because of nonprofit motivations. According to one study in 1980, 70% of university faculty had tenure. Today, it's only 30%. And then he goes on to talk about how much of science today is based upon money. Money from special interest groups. Now here's the rub. Whoever pays for the research ends up getting the benefit. And large amounts of money will go to a department. And the head of a department, they'll chair a department, maybe give $500,000, $1 million a year just for a chair. That means that whatever you're told to do, you do it. And that's where most of our science comes today. Well, he went on to find that a plant-based vegan diet was, quote, the best diet there was. But that only came after he had spent most of his career trying to promote an animal-based diet. What I like about T. Colin Campbell is he's very open, very honest, as is his son, who's also a medical doctor. And in fact, his son just wrote a paper about how the more meat you eat, the more cancer you have, the more likely you are to die of all diseases quicker, substantially faster. Now, why I find this important is that I also understood what happens when you work in a highly respected institution. I worked in a very orthodox institution. They were doing research on chemotherapy and drugs. I was the oddball, the only person doing nutrition research, and specifically nutrition research on anti-aging. And once a month, we would have an opportunity, the 16 different departments, to present their information. And mine was always the one that people just weren't interested in and brushed aside. Because at that point, people simply did not believe, no matter what evidence was presented, no matter how many scientific studies, that nutrition had anything to do with disease outside of classic kwashiorkor, kwashiorkor, and if you didn't have classical nutritional deficiencies, if you weren't wasting away, then it didn't matter what you eat. Eat anything, and it was fine, in moderation. And so I did a study that showed if I fasted rats, they lived 22% longer. Now, this was 7 years before Dr. Roy Warford did his work at UCLA. My work was considered so unorthodox that they wouldn't even submit to peer review. Over 119 studies that I did, which were very revealing, never submitted. But later I would submit a study that showed that by consuming a plant-based diet, 100% plant-based, that rats could live substantially longer. Also by giving them a non-confinement, a very spacious environment, by giving them natural full-spectrum lighting, by playing light classical music. And I did this 3 times. This was a long study, over 5 years. Finally, I was allowed to submit this, and it took 12 years before it was published in the peer-reviewed journal. Why? Because just like Colin Campbell, people didn't want to believe that the paradigm that they had accepted was wrong. So this had nothing to do with science and evidence. I had absolute evidence that every plant had all 8 amino acids, every legume, every grain, every nut, every seed, in different quantities, but they were all complete, meaning your body didn't have to produce them, meaning you never again had to eat anything from an animal in order to get all your protein. In fact, at one point, to see the difference, I had the Natural Living and Running Walk Club 110 members train for and do 2 marathons in 1 year, the New York Marathon, and then the Waterfront Marathon and the Jersey Shore Marathon. They could do either one. But we did 2 marathons in a year. We trained for a year. We were vegan, no alcohol, no drugs, and our immune systems were in phenomenal shape compared to another 100 people from our group who ate their normal diet. They still did the marathons. Their immune systems were in the toilet. It took much longer to recover. So it established that a vegan or plant-based diet would help your overall immune system, lower your body mass index, meaning you'd have less fat. And every study shows that the less fat you have to your ideal fat level, the longer you're going to live, the less heart disease, diabetes, etc. But people didn't want to hear it. Nobody wanted to know. So this is the takeaway message. We put so much emphasis upon science. Science is the final arbiter of what is right. And we shouldn't. Because what we have today in America is so much corrupted science, proprietary science, commercial science. But you won't always know that. You won't know what's behind the research. We're now seeing through the film Vax, which I recommend people see, that they were lying about the safety and efficacy of vaccines, totally corrupt their whole department of vaccination. We know that the FDA has been taken over by special interest groups So don't trust anything they tell you about the safety of genetically modified foods or that a drug is both effective and safe. They have no real proof of that, only the evidence presented by the people who make a profit from it, and we show that they're biased. We just had millions of bees die this week in Virginia when they sprayed for the Zika virus, and they just all died. But we've been telling them, be careful about what you're spraying. They don't care. There's no consequence today. If you're in power, you can do just about anything. You don't have a downside. And what do? They hire the science, the institutions who are going to back them. Now, to show you how insidious it is, in the next 2 days, I'll be presenting an original in-depth investigative report going behind the scenes on the subject of GMOs. We finally broke the code. I told you I was getting some very bright people in to protect us from being hacked, but also I want to find out who are these people? Who are the real people guiding all these PR campaigns with all the trolls and the character assassins? Well, we found them. All of it. Everything about them. Names, companies, foundations. I'll be presenting that to you and published in the next 2 days. And that goes for almost everything out there is in commerce surrounding it. So Colin Campbell, took you more than a half of your professional career to find the truth. And then when you did find it, nobody wanted to change because of it. That's the other part of the reality he had to face. Now, from Northumbria University, there's a good study on the effect of beet. Now, you might hear it as beets or beetroot. It's the same thing. It's a root vegetable. And the study simply measured the effect of what happens in allowing muscles of athletes to recover. And they received either placebo or they received the beet juice. And they found that there was a substantial improvement in recovery of muscle fatigue when you had the beets. So the takeaway message is, if you're going to be doing exercise of any type, biking, walking, running, jogging, take 6 to 8 ounces of beet juice, another 6 to 8 ounces of either watermelon juice or coconut water. It's good for you, and you'll like it. From the Institute of Cancer Research in London, women who take, quote, a common form of hormone replacement therapy are nearly 300% more likely to get breast cancer, a major study has found. Quote, scientists at the Institute of Cancer Research in London say the risks of taking the pills have been underestimated for years, and they are actually 60% higher than thought. The findings, based upon a study of 39,000 women tracked as they went through the menopause, will, quote, reignite a 20-year debate about the benefits and risks of taking hormone replacement therapy. The research found women who took the combination form of hormone replacement therapy, which contains both a estrogen and a progesterone, were almost 300% more likely to develop breast cancer over 5 years, and those who did not take it. This was a large study. So here's something that we should understand. This is not 20 years. This is more likely 40 years. Here's what you should know. When you take synthetic hormone replacement therapy, you are more likely by at least 13%, and there are 10 million American women taking it, so that's 1,300,000 women per year, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, heart attack, stroke, colorectal cancer, and dementia. All of those are killers. And yet, why do you take it? So you can lessen hot flashes and remineralize the bone. You can remineralize the bone with a simple bone supplement. Calcium, magnesium, boron, phosphorus, silica, genistein, and you can remineralize the bone. And hot flashes, Vitex. Very simple, Dong Quai. And that way you have no downside, only upside. And finally, 69% of more than two-thirds of patients currently using the most commonly prescribed antidepressant medications, quote, never met the criteria for major depressive disorder. That's according to the peer-reviewed Journal of Clinical Psychiatry. Quote, many individuals who are prescribed and use antidepressant medications may not have met criteria for mental disorders. Our data indicate that antidepressants are commonly used in the absence of clear evidence-based indications. Okay. We're talking about Prozac and Paxil and Zoloft. We're talking about people who can end up with depression and anxiety disorders and suicidal tendencies from taking the drugs. So a person has depression, and instead of dealing with it as would be a healthier way through some form of psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, counseling, they're told that they have a brain chemical imbalance. Not true. You have a life situation. And during different life situations where our moods change, it's completely normal for people to seek some help and counseling. But you don't have a brain chemical imbalance. That doesn't exist, and they know it. Look, we all at different times have sadness. We have inappropriate guilt. We lack concentration. We become restless. We can develop some insomnia or extreme fatigue. We can feel irritable. Depending upon what we're faced with and how we have been conditioned to respond to these crises in life, we need some humanistic, holistic insight and compassion. We do not need a drug. And this is simply saying, wow, two-thirds of the people taking these antidepressants, you're not even clinically depressed, so there is no such thing as a safe drug. So you put yourself at risk. Seek holistic natural therapies, not psychiatry. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with our guests. Please stand by.
You better stop, yeah, dogging me around. If you don't stop, yeah, I'm gonna put you down. I can't take it much longer. My heart's getting weak.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Noll. We take on all the issues here, and one of the issues is being vigorously challenged by the President of the United States, by Hillary Clinton, the State Department, the conservative think tanks. They're on the side of don't go after Saudi Arabia, no matter what Saudi Arabia may have contributed to 9/11, because we could lose a lot of money. We could jeopardize oil. We could jeopardize arms, which are in the tens of billions of dollars a year. And then there are those who say, but if such a heinous crime as 9/11 was in any way contributed to by 9/11, powers that be, shouldn't they be held accountable? And if we knew anyone else as individuals or a group were responsible, we would have been on them in a heartbeat. Look what we did. We caused a whole invasion of a country in Afghanistan and also in Iraq based upon the idea that somehow Saddam Hussein was associated. He was not. Or that somehow Al-Qaeda was hanging out in Afghanistan, and they were responsible. They were not. Two separate issues altogether. The Taliban had nothing to do with 9/11. So where do you come down on this? Let's speak with one of the victims, Lori Van Acklen. She lost her husband, Kenneth, and she has Ken and Lori, her two children, and also Sarah and Matthew, then age 12 and 14, respectively. And she is with a group of women from New Jersey, including the Family Steering Committee for the 9/11 Commission, and they continue to struggle for justice for those murdered on 9/11. including getting the bill H.R. 3815, that's H.R. 3815, Justice Against Monstrous Terrorism, or JASTA, passed through Congress, which removes sovereign immunity from any nation directly involved in terrorism, including 9/11, thereby enabling them to be held liable in court. Now, Lori, the House equivalent of this bill already passed unanimously through the Senate last May. However, even if it passes through the House, President Obama has threatened to veto it. My listeners need to understand what this bill entails, why it's important, and especially in the context of evidence in the recently declassified 20 pages from the 9/11 Commission, which were only a part. I have information that there were over 80,000 pages that the FBI still has involving 9/11, involving Saudi Arabia, that have never been released, that could implicate Saudi Arabia as a financer in the attacks on 9/11. Take your time. Explain why this is important. The forum is yours.
Hi, first of all, thank you for having me on. Recently declassified 28 pages were held for 13 and a half years, and they essentially detailed the ways that Saudi Arabia worked behind the scenes to finance September 11th, at least from our reading, that's what it seems. There were a couple of Saudi intelligence officers that seem to have been assigned the task of establishing Hazmi and Midhar, the two San Diego hijackers, getting them apartments and helping them, through, getting their driver's licenses and flight lessons. And in this way, and it's only two of the hijackers that are detailed pretty much in the 28 pages, there are 15 of the 19 hijackers who are from Saudi Arabia. So there's scads of information we still don't have, including those 80,000 documents in Florida, which may also deal with Mohammed Atta and al-Shaghi, two other of the hijackers. There's a lot of information we still don't know, but there's enough information in those 28 pages that should tell us that we should lift the veil of sovereign immunity from Saudi Arabia and allow the 9/11 families to continue their lawsuit, which was begun in 2002. And we should be allowed to, despite what anybody says, find out the truth. That's what we have, the court for, discovery, and to be able to hold them accountable if it is found that indeed they participated in the attacks that killed 3,000 people.
President Obama has already threatened to veto the bill if it gets passed through the Congress. And obviously, for anyone who has followed the story of the 20 pages of the Joint Inquiry of Congress, there is clearly an intention to protect certain parties and nations and individuals. What are the supporters and sponsors of the bill saying as to why the White House opposes it?
Well, first of all, the bill, as you said, passed with unanimous consent through the Senate in May, and we are hoping so that Speaker Ryan will put it on the calendar as soon as the House gets back in session, which is September 6th. And if he puts it on the calendar, we understand that it should pass, through the House with enough votes to make it so that if the president vetoes it, there could be another vote to override the veto. So this is what we're hoping for with the unanimous consent. Of course, we already have enough votes, 100% of the senators voted for it, so we're okay in the Senate. Why they would continue to, try to protect Saudi Arabia is anyone's guess, but I think you gave some good possible reasons. We certainly think that the decimation that happened in Lower Manhattan on September 11th and the death of 3,000 people, nobody should have immunity for that.
But right now, the President of the United States and the entire military-industrial complex, including Homeland Security, the 80,000 raids by SWAT teams last year, the vast majority had nothing to do with someone who represented a threat to America, its security, or committed a criminal act. Most were based upon civil fines. And plus all those people who had been killed by drones, the people who make the drones, the pilots who fly those drones out of bunkers in air-conditioned setting out in Las Vegas or other parts of the world, the people that build the drones, the people who build the arms. On their side, they're saying, hey, look, So you lost 3,000 people. But look at the money we get each year. And isn't that equally important? That's their rationale. That's their argument. The President of the United States and Hillary Clinton, even more than that, than Barack Obama, has said that she will defend Saudi Arabia, that she will not challenge them and has never challenged them on, for example, beheadings. She was responsible through the State Department to recommend to the UN that Saudi Arabia head, the actual head, the Human Rights Commission at the United Nations. And yet, thus far this year, Saudi Arabia has beheaded more individuals than ISIS. And also, it's now going to be beheading homosexuals. They have refused to allow women to drive, refused to allow women to have any rights. There's no freedom of religion. There's only one religion allowed in Saudi Arabia. They do not allow any freedom of press, any freedom of assembly. One person challenged the regime on his lack of freedom, and he was given 1,000 lashes and 10 years in prison. And it's our government did not go to his defense. We have gone to no one's defense, including a nonviolent sheikh who was not Sunni. He was Shia. And so here is Hillary Clinton taking money from the Saudi Arabians through the Clinton Foundation, the largest, second largest donors. It's close to $35 million. And she celebrated. We actually now had the transcripts of her celebrating on a Christmas Eve with a party, some dinner party, because they had just closed some big deal. I think it was around $58 billion in arms sales to Saudi Arabia. President Obama and Hillary Clinton and everyone at the CIA and everyone at the National Security Agency and everyone in the military of any rank know that Saudi Arabia has invaded the poorest country, Yemen, has been engaged in massive civilian casualties, over 4,000, and not a single criticism from our State Department, the President of the United States. So if you're a neocon, and they control Washington, D.C., if you're the Clinton machine and they control the American media, from the New York Times to CNN, they control it. Anyone who thinks otherwise is extraordinarily naive. They're saying, get over your 3,000 dead. So it happened. They're our friend, and we make money from them. And there's just too damn much money being made for you now to hold them accountable, because what would happen if you brought them in and held them and they were found guilty? What would happen if they suddenly had to pay for all the fines? They're not going to buy anything more from the United States. It could impact our oil and our other relationships in the Middle East. And also, it would impact our relationship with Israel, because Israel and Saudi Arabia have a relationship. So they're saying, look at the larger good. That's their argument. That's the President of the United States. That's Hillary Clinton. And if she becomes president, if you think Barack Obama was a sellout neoconservative acting like a liberal, then you have no idea what's waiting you in Hillary and Bill Clinton. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I asked you that. So that was a lot of, you know, a lot of information. But, you know, obviously this began, you know, under Bush Cheney, and the Saudi relationship was very tight with, you know, President Bush and Bandar Bush, as he was known. As far as, you know, our government's policy, when you go down to Washington, behind closed doors, a couple of senators have said to us, the United States does some very bad things. We say, please stop doing those bad things. Please don't do that in my name. Please don't use 9/11 to hide behind to do those bad things. You know, we feel that 3,000 dead deserve to have accountability. We feel that, you know, destroying Lower Manhattan deserves to have accountability. We think it's a deterrent for other terrorism that could occur on our soil to pass JASTA and to be able to take Saudi Arabia into court of law. So essentially, we disagree with what they're saying as far as, you know, selling them arms and you know, and all that sort of thing, because I wouldn't, if it were up to me, I wouldn't sell arms to a country that I knew was going to do terrible things with those arms. But I'm just one person, and, you know, one person who's been fighting for justice for the death of my husband for 15 years. So, you know, I wish I could wave a magic wand and fix Washington and, you know, and wake everybody up, but...
Lori, none of us had the power to change the corruption and the lack of spiritual, ethical values in that cesspool of Washington, D.C. We're just trying to let people know that there's a rationale for their wanting to protect Saudi Arabia at all cost. And I think that the American public now should understand the real value of human life here. By the way, how many Palestinians have been killed in the different incursions in Gaza? It exceeds 3,000. And yet we won't raise a finger to try to stop that either. Let's call the House leader, Kevin McCarthy, on this. The House Speaker is Paul...
That's right. I'm sorry. You're right.
Paul Ryan is the House Speaker. His phone number is 202-225-3031. Press 6 and leave a message. Be polite, but be firm that you want to see this bill passed without amendment, so that H.R. 3815, so that Saudi Arabia or any nation that was a participant in 9/11 can be held accountable. That's 202-225-3031. And also the House leader is Representative Kevin McCarthy. His phone number is 202-225-2915. And that's H.R. 3815. And you want the exact language of the Senate bill 2040 to be voted on as a standalone bill before the 15th anniversary of 9/11. So that's what we can do. Again, two phone numbers to call, 202-225-3031. Press 6, leave a message, or 202-225-2915. Leave a message. And I thank you, Lori Van Aken, for coming on and sharing your feelings about your loss, tragic loss, and also speaking on behalf of everyone else who was a victim of 9/11.
Thank you so much.
I'm Gary Knoll. Time for you to share your thoughts. Remember, a vote for Hillary Clinton is a vote to protect Saudi Arabia or any other Middle Eastern country that we do business with from any liability, any harm to their reputation, and also to continue arms shipments to them and through them to terrorist groups. And this, by the way, was also in Hillary Clinton's cables, where she was actually talking about knowing that arms went to Saudi Arabia, would go to al-Nusra and al-Qaeda, etc. So they knew full well that, yes, American manufacturers who got money to the Clinton Foundation, gave it, were creating weapons that would end up being used by terrorists and innocent civilians hurt. But that's their game plan. They just didn't count upon anyone getting the truth, having these 38 pages made public. Your thoughts, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. We're going to take a brief break and come back with your calls. We've got a lot more to share with you today. And also, for those of you who heard that really insightful program on Progressive Commentary Hour, and also we played it yesterday on our sister station, WBAI, I was just informed, I'm out on the road, that we had, wow, what was it, 20,000 downloads in an hour? So there's a whole lot of people listening. And let me give you the phone numbers. Now, one number, there's like 12 different ones. Why am I giving you a different number to listen live each day, Monday to Friday at noon? Because if we ever get so busy that there's no more room on that line for you, you've got all these other numbers you can call. So I'm giving you a whole bunch. Today, here's a new number. Write this down, please. No matter where you're at noon, anywhere in America or Canada, you can call this number and listen live. Like tomorrow, 424 424-203-8046. That's 424-203-8046. But let's say you missed a show. You can't listen. You're at work. You're traveling, but you want to hear an important program, and you can only listen at 11 o'clock at night. You can pick up any portable listening device, your cell phone, off your computer, and here is the number you call to listen to the archives live. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. Let's say hello to Jerry from New York. Hi, Jerry, your turn.
Gary, I understand about the claim of Saudi Arabia being involved in 9/11. Was the United States also a part of that? Was it partly an inside job? That's a question I have. I'll take my answer on here.
Okay. We cannot prove that. There is circumstantial evidence, but there is no prima facie hard evidence. Now, coming up, I'm doing a six-hour special. All brand new information on 9/11 from noon to 6 p.m. And the people that I'm interviewing are all expert in their field. And none of what we're talking about have you heard before. And this will lay out their evidence that will hopefully take it from circumstantial on who participated, how they would do it, who had the means to do it, and what is the proof that the official report was flawed. All that will be presented. Can I prove anything right now? I cannot. What I can prove absolutely, unequivocally, and in fact I'm on a panel at Cooper Union to discuss this, I can absolutely prove that the official report is incorrect. I can absolutely prove that you could not have had three buildings in complete free fall based upon the rationale that we were given, and there are over 2,000 scientists who support that same conclusion. So if you know that what you're told is wrong, then you have to ask them what would be the motive to make it wrong, who would benefit, and then what is the right part of that. So half the equation we can absolutely prove. The other half, we're bringing together the different bits and pieces to see if we can't get a clearer picture. But was Saudi Arabia involved? You bet. Did we know they were involved? We did. What would have happened to the Bush family relationship and the money that the Bushes made through that relationship? What would happen to all the entities that they own? What would happen to all the debt, the American T-bills, our treasury bills that they purchased to help us? What would happen to their assets, their bank accounts? What would happen to the price of oil? What would happen to their own security? The only reason that the House of Saud exists at all against their own people who hate them is because we have been spending billions of dollars a year to defend them. They're in a house of cards. It's going to collapse. Thank you for your call. Lincoln from New York. Hi, Lincoln. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, hi there. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, I was about to make similar comments as that fellow. It seems to me like if Saudi Arabia was indeed involved, they were used as a ruse to prevent the focus from where it really originates, which seems to be Israel and America. And, for example, the finding of nanothermite, and also which only the U.S. government military have access to found in the debris. I also want to make a comment on a lot of times when I hear you and many people talk about Gaddafi and about the wonderful things Gaddafi have done, which I was speaking about since I was a child because I knew about Gaddafi since I was in my teens. People are always saying, we're not saying he was a perfect man. We don't have to make any excuses for Gaddafi because there are people in the U.S. government who are much, much worse, have done much worse things than Gaddafi. And America is not a perfect country. And so whenever we speak of Gaddafi or any of these people or Chavez, we don't have to make excuses and say, well, we're not saying they were perfect. Nobody in American government is perfect. And none of them reach the standard of what Gaddafi reached. So I think we should stop always making those excuses like, he wasn't totally perfect, Do you follow where I'm coming from?
Sure I do, Lincoln, and that's why I played a 1 hour and 20 minute report on Libya done by the BBC that showed the truth about Libya and Gaddafi, that he was not a threat to anyone. He had brought stability and peace to most of Africa. He wanted the gold denier to go off the dollar to the gold denier for his light crude oil, that his country had the highest literacy rate in the world, highest, that he had virtually no poverty, no crime, and all the things that he did. And yet you cannot at the same time, if you're the United States or its apologist in the media, condemn him, vilify him, demonize him, destroy his character, make him out to be a virtual Hitler, and then turn around and say, he was Hitler, he was a demon, he was killing his people, but it wasn't true, he wasn't. His soldiers were raping people after they took Viagra. It was all made up PR story, and we have proof of that. So it's confusing. How can you have so many good things happening in a country, and a country love a person so much over 40 years, and the greatest, the most functional democracy in the world was in Libya? It destroyed America's concept of democracy. Our democracy is a fraud. You buy power, and then you moniker it with the name democracy. There, nothing could happen anywhere in Libya on any level unless citizens' committees voted on it, and it had to be based upon their vote, not Gaddafi's. So you see, it's almost creating a schizophrenic reaction. Could one man so evil, so vile, allow anything good in his country? Historically, the answer is no. Unless you're just the very rich, and that wasn't the case in there. But we can't be objective about any of these people. Assad in Syria, the same way. So that's why you have to do your homework. You have to look for the truth and never start with the official media as the truth, not even the left media, because they're just as capable of being corrupted ideologically, politically, as any of the other media. But let's finish today by hearing from a nurse warning about forced flu shots in hospitals where she worked. Please listen to this.
And she is a medical professional who has insight and information that you're going to want to hear. So go right ahead, Tina. Tell us what you've learned.
Okay. Since the Affordable Care Act came out, we are now, as nurses, required to ask every single patient when they come to the hospital if you've had your flu vaccine or your pneumococcal vaccine. If you say no to either one of those, in the computer, an order will generate that says we need to give you this vaccine. We don't need to speak to a doctor. It's hospital policy. It's now health department policy that we now have to give you the vaccine. Even if you came to the hospital with a stubbed toe, you will be offered both vaccines if you meet requirements, which just about everybody meets requirements for flu vaccine. And most people over the age of 65 will meet the pneumococcal vaccine. Even if you come to the hospital with a stubbed toe, you are going to be given this vaccine. You have the right to say no. If you say no, they just check it off as refused. This was never like this years ago. This is a new thing.
And tell me what we were discussing before about surgery and your admission that you hadn't had these recent vaccines. Tell me about this protocol, because I don't think that people, in fact, I know that there are many people that are not aware of this.
When you go to the hospital, if you need surgery, you need a knee replacement surgery, first they're going to ask you if you've had the vaccines. You're going to say no.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're going to say, well, you need to sign this consent. If you're going to have surgery, you need to sign a consent. In the consent, there's a word called biogenics. If you sign the consent saying, I consent for you to give me biogenics, that basically means that they can give you anything that they deem necessary, including vaccines. So if you say you didn't get a flu shot, it's flu season, and you sign the consent that says I agree to biogenics, they will give you a vaccine even when you're under anesthesia because you already signed the consent.
So you might not even know you received the vaccine.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Unless you go and get your medical records, you will not know that you got a flu vaccine. They may tell you at the end, oh, by the way, you're now covered, you got the flu vaccine, or you got the pneumococcal vaccine. But two people now have reported to me last week saying that they got the vaccine. They did not want the vaccine. They didn't know that word biogenics meant that they're going to get a vaccine, because vaccine falls under the title of biogenics.
Biogenics.
It's new terminology that I myself just realized.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is profound. So how can people, with your insight, protect themselves from being vaccinated against their wishes?
You can, when you sign consent for surgery, you can specifically say, no vaccines, I don't want this. Like, you can write an initial after what you say you do not want, and they have to honor that. And if they don't honor it, they can be sued.
Right. So we do need to be educated to protect ourselves.
Now, let's go one step further. For those of you who still believe that vaccines are safe and effective, I would recommend that you read any one of the 41 separate articles, the latest was just posted 2 weeks ago, that I've written on the subject of safety and efficacy. They're fully vetted. They're fully referenced with good quality scientific references. And then ask yourself, knowing the good science, the independent science, that shows that no vaccine is safe or effective, why then would you do it? And especially if you didn't know when going into a hospital you could get one of the most dangerous vaccines, the most worthless vaccine, that there's no science supporting it, is the flu vaccine. Okay? Thank you all for listening. Got a powerful show tomorrow at noon, so make sure that you wrote down the number so you can listen live, 424-203-8046. Have a nice day, everyone.